I've been a mountain rescue ranger for over 5 years now, navigating the treacherous terrain and unpredictable elements that come with the territory. Through countless missions, I've grown accustomed to the harrowing sights of accidents, injuries, and even deaths. But nothing, absolutely nothing, could have prepared me for the sheer terror of what unfolded last year. It began like any other day, with the sun barely breaking through the dense canopy of trees as I received a distress signal. My heart sank at the urgency in the voice on the other end of the line. It was a group of hikers, lost in the wild, their desperation palpable even through the crackling static of the satellite phone. 6 friends, they said, embarking on a journey to explore the remote and rugged expanse of the mountain range. It was a notorious area, known for its unforgiving terrain of dense forests and perilous cliffs. A sudden storm had struck, disorienting them, and they had been wandering for days, deprived of the most basic necessities, food, water, and shelter. Their voices trembled with fear as they confessed to feeling hunted, stalked by some unseen force lurking in the shadows. As a seasoned ranger, I knew the wilderness could play tricks on the mind. Yet the urgency in their plea spurred me into action. With a sense of duty and determination, I swiftly assembled a team of 4 other rangers, each one armed with expertise and resolve. We loaded our gear and supplies into the waiting helicopter, ready to embark on a rescue mission unlike any other. The coordinates of the distress signal led us deep into the heart of the wilderness, miles away from the nearest town. As we approached the designated area, a thick shroud of fog descended, enveloping the landscape in an eerie silence. Communication with the hikers became increasingly difficult, their voices fading into the static abyss. Unable to land safely, we touched down on a nearby clearing, the fog swirling ominously around us. Splitting into teams, my partner Tom and I ventured into the mist-shrouded forest, our senses on high alert. Despite our GPS devices and maps, the fog obscured our vision, reducing visibility to a mere few feet ahead. Hour after hour, we trudged through the dense undergrowth, our footsteps muffled by the damp earth beneath us. The fog seemed to thicken with each passing moment, casting an oppressive weight upon our shoulders. A sense of unease crept over me, gnawing at the edges of my consciousness. Then, in a small clearing ahead, I stumbled upon a scene that froze the blood in my veins. The remnants of a tent lay torn and shredded, surrounded by scattered belongings strewn haphazardly across the forest floor. It was a chilling sight, made all the more unsettling by the presence of something lurking in the shadows. Standing behind a gnarled tree, illuminated by the pale light filtering through the fog, was a creature unlike anything I had ever seen. Its form was hunched and grotesque, its eyes gleaming with an otherworldly intensity. Claws extended from its humanoid hands, poised to strike with deadly precision. I fumbled for my radio, my hands trembling as I sought to alert Tom to the imminent danger. Before I could utter a word, a piercing scream shattered the silence, echoing through the forest with spine-chilling intensity. Without hesitation, I raced towards the sound, driven by a primal instinct to protect my comrade at any cost. As I reached the edge of the clearing, I beheld a sight that filled me with dread. Tom stood before me, his face contorted in terror, as he too became aware of the malevolent presence lurking in the shadows. The air hung heavy with anticipation, the tension palpable as we braced ourselves for the unknown. What followed was a desperate race for survival, our footsteps pounding against the forest floor as we fled from the encroaching darkness. With each passing moment, the laughter of our pursuers grew louder, a twisted cacophony that echoed through the trees with relentless ferocity. Through sheer determination, we managed to reach the safety of the helicopter, our hearts pounding with exertion as we surveyed the forest beyond. Dozens of eyes glimmered in the darkness, watching us with an unspoken menace that sent shivers down my spine. In the aftermath of our ordeal, Tom and I were left shaken to our core, haunted by the memory of that fateful encounter. The hikers remained lost to the wilderness, their fate a grim reminder of the dangers that lurked beyond the safety of civilization. Though I remain a ranger, My days of venturing into that cursed part of the woods are long behind me. The memory of those yellow eyes, burning with malice in the darkness, serves as a stark reminder of the thin veil that separates us from the unknown horrors that dwell within the heart of the wilderness. The sun was just beginning to dip below the horizon, casting long shadows through the dense canopy of Raven Forest, when I started my routine check of the remote campsites. I've patrolled these woods for over 15 years, long enough to know every trail and clearing like the back of my hand. Or so I thought. That day, as I steered my truck down the narrow dirt road toward Campsite 12, a prickling sense of unease began to gnaw at the edge of my consciousness. It was too quiet. Raven Forest, with its sprawling acres of wilderness, had always been a place of serene isolation, a refuge from the clamor of the outside world. But this silence was different, unnatural. There was no laughter of children playing, no chatter of campers, no crackle of firewood burning, just the muted rustle of leaves in the gentle evening breeze. As I parked my truck and made my way on foot to the campsite, the feeling of wrongness intensified. I reached for the radio clipped to my belt, half expecting to receive a call that would explain the eerie stillness, but the line was dead silent. Pushing through the underbrush, I finally emerged into the clearing of Campsite 12 and stopped dead in my tracks. The scene before me was one of chaos. Tents were shredded, their fabric torn open by some tremendous force. Camping gear was scattered across the ground, as if tossed aside by a storm. But there had been no storm. As my eyes adjusted to the fading light, I noticed darker stains splattered across the canvas of one tent. Blood. My heart rate quickened. I drew my flashlight, sweeping its beam across the devastation. Fragments of clothing hung from the branches like grotesque decorations, fluttering slightly in the breeze. And then I saw them. The carvings, symbols, unfamiliar and unsettling, were etched deep into the bark of the trees surrounding the campsite. They seemed to twist and writhe in the flickering light of my flashlight, casting long, ominous shadows that danced across the ground. A shiver ran down my spine, a primal reaction to the desolation before me. This wasn't the work of a bear or any animal I knew. Something else had been here, something far more sinister. I forced myself to move, to start the search for any survivors or clues as to what had happened here. That's when I found the footprints. Massive, far larger than any human's, with deep grooves that suggested an unimaginable weight. I followed the tracks, my mind racing with possibilities, but they led only to more confusion. After several hundred feet, the footprints simply vanished, as if whatever made them had taken flight, or, impossibly, leaped kilometers in a single bound. I clicked on my radio, seeking the comfort of another human voice, but was met only with static. "Interference from the cliffs," I muttered to myself, though I knew that was unlikely. The silence pressed in around me, suffocating. There were no bird calls, no rustle of wildlife through the underbrush, just my footsteps and the pounding of my heart in the growing dusk. With darkness encroaching and my sense of unease mounting, I made the decision to head back to the campsite. I needed to secure a perimeter, to build a fire against the night. As I lay out my bedroll, the hairs on my arms stood on end, as though I were being watched by unseen eyes from beyond the firelight. Exhaustion eventually took hold, pulling me into a fitful sleep plagued by nightmares of darkness and whispers in the forest. But the true horror was yet to come. The night pressed in like a physical thing, heavy and oppressive, as if the darkness itself bore weight. I've spent countless nights alone in the wilderness, but nothing had prepared me for the palpable sense of dread that enveloped Campsite 12 as twilight turned to pitch black. The once familiar sounds of the forest were absent, replaced by an eerie silence that felt like a warning. I tried the radio again, hoping for any sign of life on the other end, but the static crackled back at me mockingly. It was as if Raven Forest itself had decided to cut me off from the rest of the world, leaving me stranded in this pocket of unnerving quiet. The logical part of my brain reasoned, It was interference from the cliffs, a natural explanation for an unnatural feeling. Yet, the unease refused to be reasoned away. Building the fire had been an act of defiance, a small beacon of light and warmth in the encroaching gloom. I watched the flames dance, casting long, flickering shadows that seemed to play tricks on my eyes. More than once, I jerked my head up, certain I'd seen movement in the periphery of the firelight, only to be met with emptiness. As the night deepened, I rolled out my bedroll, a futile attempt to prepare for rest in a place that now felt anything but restful. My body ached for sleep, but my mind raced, replaying the day's discoveries over and over. The torn tents, the strange carvings on the trees, those ungodly large footprints that vanished into thin air. All of it churned in my thoughts, refusing to coalesce into any semblance of understanding. When sleep finally claimed me, it was a restless, fitful thing, filled with shadows that whispered and mocked. Dreams of being chased through an endless dark forest by something unseen but felt, its breath hot on my neck, its footsteps heavy and implacable. I woke gasping, the fire reduced to embers, the darkness complete. And then, the feeling of being watched intensified, a pressure on my chest that made it hard to breathe. My skin crawled with the sensation of unseen eyes fixed upon me, assessing, waiting. I reached for the flashlight, needing to pierce the darkness, to prove to myself it was all in my head. But when I clicked it on, nothing happened. Dead. Panic, raw and unthinking, bubbled up from somewhere deep inside. I was a ranger, trained to remain calm in the face of danger, but this was something beyond my training. Something primal in me recognized the threat in the darkness, the danger that lurked just beyond the firelight. It was then I noticed the vines. They hadn't been there before, I was sure of it. Yet now they encircled the bottom of my tent, thick and sinuous, like the coils of some great serpent. They seemed to pulse with a life of their own, and a stench wafted from them, sickly sweet and rotting. My stomach churned. Desperation lent me strength. I couldn't stay here, trapped and waiting for whatever horror the night held to come for me. Grabbing my knife, I slashed at the tent fabric, cutting a ragged hole to clamber through. I tumbled out into the blackness, the fire nothing but a memory, the darkness complete and all-consuming. The forest I thought I knew had turned against me, a labyrinth of shadows and fear. And somewhere in that darkness, something waited. The darkness of Raven Forest was total, a thick blanket that smothered every hint of light. My breath came in sharp gasps, misting in the cold air as I stumbled forward, driven by a primal urge to escape. The comforting weight of my flashlight, now useless, was a bitter reminder of how unprepared I was for what lay hidden in these woods. Every rustle, every snap of a twig underfoot, sent jolts of fear through me. I had ventured into the night countless times before, but this was different. This was not the respectful fear of a predator's domain I had felt on previous patrols. This was terror, pure and unadulterated, for an enemy I could not see, could not understand. The orbs of light had appeared suddenly, twin points of cold predatory intelligence that watched from the darkness. Their glow was unnatural, unlike any bioluminescence or camper's lantern. They pulsed with a malevolent light, tracking my movements with an intensity that turned my blood to ice. And then the screams started, an unearthly chorus that shattered the oppressive silence, echoing through the trees, surrounding me. I ran. The rational part of my brain screamed at me to stop, to think, to try and make sense of what was happening, but fear overrode everything. Branches lashed at my face, leaving stinging welts in their wake. Roots seemed to conspire against me, snaring my boots, sending me sprawling time and again into the underbrush. The laughter that followed my flight was madness given voice, a cacophony of sounds that seemed almost human but twisted into something vile. It nipped at my heels, a constant reminder that I was prey in a hunt I did not understand. Then, in a moment of sheer panic, my foot caught on something solid. The ground disappeared beneath me, and I was falling, tumbling into the abyss. The air was knocked from my lungs as I hit the water below with a bone-jarring impact. Cold enveloped me, a frigid embrace that threatened to pull me under. Sputtering, I fought my way to the surface, gasping for air. My hands found the slick, moss-covered rocks at the edge of an underground lake, the darkness complete, save for the faintest glimmer of light from above. It was then I saw them, pale, lifeless bodies floating in the water around me, their faces frozen in expressions of horror. Nausea twisted my gut, but fear spurred me into action. I couldn't stay here, in this watery grave. Scrambling onto the rocky shore, I searched desperately for a way out. My fingers found a crevice in the rock, narrow and unwelcoming, but it was a chance. I squeezed through the opening, ignoring the scrape of stone against skin, the claustrophobic press of the earth around me. The passage was barely wide enough to move, but I pushed forward, driven by the need to escape, to survive. Emerging into the cold pre-dawn light, I collapsed, my breaths coming in ragged sobs. The horrors of the night were behind me, but the terror remained, etched into my very soul. Raven Forest had revealed a darkness beyond my wildest fears, a malevolence that stalked the shadows. As I lay there, waiting for the first rays of the sun to banish the night, I knew one thing with absolute certainty. I could never return to these woods. The unseen horrors that dwelled within were beyond understanding, beyond fighting. They had marked me, changed me, and I was lucky to have escaped with my life. Dawn broke with a gentleness that felt like a mockery of the night's terror. The first rays of light filtered through the dense canopy, illuminating a world that seemed unchanged, untouched by the horrors I had endured. I lay there on the forest floor, my body a map of bruises and cuts, my mind reeling from the night's events. The pale bodies in the water, the screams, the eyes in the darkness, all of it haunted the fringes of my consciousness. A nightmare that had breached the realm of reality. The sound of voices broke through my stupor, distant at first, but growing steadily closer. A search party, I realized, their calls for the missing campers bouncing off the trees. I should have felt relief at the prospect of rescue, of returning to the world of the living, but instead, a deep gnawing fear settled in my gut. How could I explain what had happened? Would they believe me? When they found me, the relief on their faces was palpable. They draped a blanket around my shoulders, their voices soothing, full of concern. But as I recounted the events of the night, their expressions shifted from sympathy to skepticism. I spoke of the footprints that led to nowhere, the vines that had ensnared my tent, the sinister laughter that chased me through the darkness, and the lake, a grave for those pale, lifeless bodies. Their skepticism was a blow, more painful than any physical wound I had suffered. They searched, of course, scouring the area where I claimed to have found the underground lake, but their efforts yielded nothing. No lake, no bodies, no evidence of the nightmarish creatures that had hunted me. Back at headquarters, the debriefing felt like an interrogation. My colleagues, people I had worked with for years, looked at me with thinly veiled suspicion. They suggested explanations that bordered on accusations, stress-induced hallucinations, a bad reaction to something I had eaten, even a veiled insinuation of substance abuse. The forest, they argued, couldn't hide such secrets, not in the age of satellites and drones. One senior officer, a man I had respected and admired, pulled me aside. "Let it go, John," he said, his voice low. "You're lucky to be alive. Whatever happened out there, you can't let it consume you. Focus on the fact that you made it back. That's all that matters." But how could I let it go? The memories were etched into my very soul, as vivid and terrifying as the moment I had lived them. I had tasted that fetid water, seen those lifeless eyes staring up at me from the depths. It was real as the ground beneath my feet, as real as the fear that now shadowed my every step. In the weeks that followed, I found myself adrift. The forest, once a place of solace and peace, had become a landscape of terror. I couldn't shake the feeling of being watched, of being followed by something just beyond the edge of vision. Sleep became an elusive dream, chased away by nightmares that left me gasping for air. I made the decision to resign not long after. I couldn't bear the thought of returning to those woods, of facing the unknown horrors that lurked in the darkness. My colleagues tried to understand, to offer words of support, but the gulf between us had grown too wide. They hadn't seen what I had seen, hadn't felt the icy grip of fear that now held me in its clutches. As I walked away from the service, from the career I had loved, I couldn't help but look back at Raven Forest, its trees standing silent and watchful. The terror of that night might have ended, but its shadows lingered, a dark stain on my soul that would never fade. In the weeks that followed my resignation, I found myself trapped in a liminal space between the world I knew and the one that had revealed itself that night in Raven Forest. The forest's shadows had seeped into my life, coloring every moment with an undercurrent of fear. I moved through my days like a ghost, haunted by memories that refused to be banished to the realm of nightmares. My colleagues, those who had worked side by side with me for over a decade, reached out with tentative offers of support and understanding. But their words, though well-intentioned, felt hollow. How could they understand? They hadn't seen the darkness that lurked beneath the serene facade of the forest, hadn't felt the primal terror of being hunted by something unfathomable. The decision to leave had been mine alone, a desperate bid to escape the memories that clung to me like a second skin. Yet, as the days passed, I realized that leaving the Forest Service hadn't brought the peace I sought. The horrors of that night followed me, an ever-present specter that lurked in the corners of my vision, waiting to pull me back into the darkness. I tried to find solace in the routine of daily life, to lose myself in the mundane tasks that had once filled my days. But the forest's call was a siren song, its whispers echoing in my mind, drawing me back to the edge of the woods that had been my home, my sanctuary. Nights were the worst. I lay awake listening to the sounds of the night, each rustle of leaves, each creak of branches, a reminder of what lay hidden in the darkness. The memories came then, unbidden and vivid, a torrent of fear and confusion that left me gasping for breath. I saw the eyes again, felt the vines wrapping around my tent, heard the laughter that had chased me through the woods. I knew then that I could never return to Raven Forest, could never again walk its paths with the ease of familiarity. The forest had changed for me, transformed from a place of natural beauty into a labyrinth of terror. It was a realization that brought with it a profound sense of loss, a mourning for the person I had been before, for the peace I had found in the embrace of the wilderness. In the end, I left, moving to a place where the forest was nothing more than a distant memory, a dark chapter in a life I was struggling to rebuild. But the shadows of Raven Forest followed me, a constant reminder of the night that had shattered my world. I told myself that it was just a bad dream, a product of stress and isolation. But in the quiet moments, when the world fell away and I was left alone with my thoughts, I knew the truth. The forest had revealed a darkness that lay hidden beneath the surface, a reminder of the ancient primal fears that dwell in the heart of man. And so, I live with the memories, with the knowledge of what lies hidden in the depths of Raven Forest. I've tried to move on, to find a semblance of peace in a world that no longer feels entirely real. But in the stillness of the night, when the wind whispers through the trees, I can hear it calling to me, a siren song that speaks of secrets buried deep in the heart of the wilderness. I'll never return to Raven Forest, but the forest and the memories it holds will never leave me. Being a game warden up in the backcountry isn't just a job for me. It's my life. I've been patrolling these woods for nearly 15 years, so you could say I know them like the back of my hand. Most days it's the same old routine, helping hikers, tracking wildlife, and keeping the peace between nature and the folks who come to enjoy it. I'm used to the calls about bears wandering into camps, or the eerie screams of mountain lions in the night. To me, that's just the sound of nature doing its thing. But nothing, and I mean nothing, could have prepared me for what happened last month. It all started with a phone call from a day hiker. I could tell right off the bat that this wasn't your typical call. The guy was out of breath, his voice shaking with fear as he told me about the blood-curdling screams he heard while hiking out at sunset. Now, I've heard cougar screams before. They can sound pretty demonic, especially during mating season, but this was different. There was something in the hiker's voice, a kind of terror you can't fake, that got my attention. Over the next few days, our dispatch got flooded with calls. Hikers were reporting the same thing, bone-chilling wails echoing through the trees at dusk near Malen Peak. The reports were coming in by the dozen, and each caller sounded more terrified than the last. As the senior guy, it fell on me to check it out. I've faced down bears and tranquilized rogue elk, but I'd be lying if I said I wasn't a bit rattled by the sheer number of calls we were getting. So, I decided to head up to the trailhead near Malen Peak myself. I timed my arrival for sunset, just like the reports had said. The drive up was uneventful, but as soon as I got out of the truck and grabbed my gear, I could feel that something was off. The woods were quiet. Too quiet. It's hard to explain, but when you've spent as much time in the forest as I have, you get to know the sounds. The rustle of leaves, the chatter of birds, the scurrying of small animals. But that evening, there was none of that. It was like even the animals were holding their breath, waiting for something to happen. I started up the path, the silence weighing heavy around me. The further I went, the more I felt like something was watching me, following my every step. I tried to shake the feeling, telling myself it was just the nerves talking, but it was no use. About a mile in, I stumbled upon something that stopped me in my tracks, weird piles of branches and twigs, all arranged in patterns on the ground. They were too neat, too precise to be natural. It looked almost like some kind of ritual thing. I've seen a lot in my years as a game warden, but this was new. I reached for my radio to call it in, but all I got back was static, and that's when I noticed my compass going haywire. I've used that compass more times than I can count, and I've never seen it act like that. It just spun randomly, no matter which way I turned. I looked up, realizing the light was fading fast, way faster than it should have been. The sky turned a bruised purple, and that's when I knew, whatever was happening here, it was nothing I'd ever dealt with before. With each step I took deeper into the woods, the sense of unease grew stronger. It was like the forest itself was holding its breath, waiting for something terrible to happen. I tried to focus on the mission at hand, to figure out the source of those eerie calls that had scared the daylights out of so many hikers. But as the silence stretched on, my own fears started to creep in. The backcountry, once a place of comfort and familiarity, now felt foreign and threatening. I was about a mile in when I stumbled upon the first pile of branches and twigs. It was arranged so precisely on the ground that it couldn't have been the work of nature. I've seen some odd things left by hikers or local kids trying to spook each other, but this was different. It looked intentional, like a symbol or a message, though I couldn't begin to guess what it meant. My mind raced with possibilities. Were people using this remote part of the forest for some kind of ritual? The thought sent a shiver down my spine. As I reported my find over the radio, all I got back was static. That's when I noticed my compass acting up. The needle spun wildly, refusing to settle in any direction. I've relied on that compass more times than I can count, and to see it fail so completely was unnerving. It was as if the very laws of nature were being twisted, leaving me disoriented in a forest that had always been my second home. Then, as the light began to fade, the forest took on an eerie glow. The sky, a deep bruised purple, seemed to press down on me. I hurried to a clearing, hoping to get a better look at the sky, but what I saw there stopped me dead in my tracks. Hovering above the trees was a massive disc-shaped object. It was unlike anything I had ever seen, perfectly round, its surface glinting with an almost liquid silver sheen. The setting sun cast strange reflections off its surface, making it seem like it was pulsating with light. It made no sound, which somehow made it even more terrifying. I stood there, rooted to the spot, staring at this UFO. It was like something straight out of the movies, yet here it was, floating in the sky above me. But the true horror lay on the ground beneath the hovering ship. Lined up evenly were five mountain lions, their bodies opened with surgical precision. It was a gruesome sight, their organs removed so cleanly that there was no blood, no mess. It looked like the work of a skilled surgeon, not any predator known to these woods. The sight of those mountain lions, so violently altered, filled me with a dread unlike any I'd felt before. Wild animals simply don't operate with such precision. This was something else, something far beyond my understanding. As I took a step back, trying to process what I was seeing, a blinding white light poured down from the ship. It was so intense, so pure, that I couldn't see anything else. It felt like it was burning right through me, leaving nothing but pain in its wake. The next thing I knew, I was lying face down in the dirt, just outside the ring of those sacrificed animals. I was disoriented, my body aching as if I'd been through a ringer. Pulling myself up, I realized I had to get back to the trailhead, no matter how. The forest, once my sanctuary, now felt like a trap closing in around me. Waking up on the forest floor was a shock. My head was pounding and my body felt like I'd just run a marathon, then got hit by a truck at the finish line. For a few moments I just lay there, trying to piece together what had happened. The last thing I remembered was the blinding light coming from that thing in the sky. Everything after that was a blur. As I slowly got to my feet, everything felt wrong. My skin burned, and when I looked down, I saw angry red patches across my arms and face. And there were marks too, strange circular marks that looked almost like crop circles. It was like something out of one of those alien movies, except it was on my skin, and it was real. I felt a wave of panic rise in my chest. What had happened to me? Stumbling through the forest, I made my way back to the trailhead, driven by a mixture of fear and determination. Every step was a struggle, my body screaming in protest, but I had to get back. I had to find help. When I finally made it back to the ranger station, my boss took one look at me and knew something was seriously wrong. Without a word, he drove me straight to the ER. The doctors ran all sorts of tests, MRI, CT scans, blood tests, but they couldn't find anything. They couldn't explain the burns, the marks, or why I felt so weak. They suggested it might be some form of electrocution, but nothing added up. It was as if whatever had happened to me was beyond their understanding. Back at work, things were different. My colleagues looked at me with a mix of concern and suspicion. Whispers of PTSD and losing it followed me around like a shadow. I tried to tell them what I saw, what I experienced, but it was clear they thought I was just rattled from being out in the woods alone. But I knew what I saw. I knew it wasn't just my imagination. Determined to find some answers, I led a team back to the site where it all happened. But when we got there, there was nothing. No ship, no marks, nothing. It was as if the forest had swallowed up all evidence of that night. We did find two of the mountain lion corpses, but the others were gone, vanished without a trace. The investigation turned up nothing conclusive. My story, backed by the physical evidence of my burns and the dead mountain lions, was met with skepticism and disbelief. Officially, the case was chalked up to unknown causes. Unofficially, I knew people thought I had cracked under the pressure. Despite everything, I couldn't shake the feeling of what I had experienced. The memory of the ship, the light, the pain, it was all too vivid, too real to be dismissed as a hallucination. But with no proof and no one willing to believe me, I was left to question my own sanity. Returning to work was hard. The whispers, the looks, the isolation, it all weighed on me. But I knew I couldn't let it break me. I had faced something unimaginable, something beyond this world, and I had survived. Whatever others thought, I knew the truth. And somehow, that had to be enough. Days turned into weeks, and the whispers at work never really stopped. I tried to ignore them, to focus on my job and pretend everything was normal. But nothing was normal anymore. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw the blinding light from the UFO, felt the heat scorching my skin. The nightmares were relentless, vivid replays of that night that left me waking up in cold sweats, heart pounding out of my chest. I became a bit of a loner, spending my lunch breaks by myself, avoiding the curious stares and hushed conversations of my colleagues. It wasn't just the physical scars that isolated me. It was the knowledge of what I had seen, what I had experienced. It set me apart in a way that was hard to bridge. The investigation into the strange occurrences in the forest was officially closed, marked as unexplained. But for me, there were still so many questions. Why me? What was that ship? Why did it leave those marks on my skin? And why did it kill those mountain lions with such precision? The lack of answers was maddening, a constant itch at the back of my mind that I couldn't scratch. I tried talking to my family about it, hoping for some semblance of understanding, or at least a comforting word. But I could see the doubt in their eyes, the underlying question of whether I had imagined the whole thing. It hurt, feeling so alienated from the people I loved, but I couldn't blame them. If I hadn't lived it, I'm not sure I would have believed it either. As the months passed, I found a sort of routine in my new reality. The scars on my skin faded into pale lines, but the marks remained, a constant reminder of that night. I started seeing a therapist, someone who didn't dismiss my experience outright, who listened and tried to help me make sense of it all. It wasn't a solution, but it was a start. One day, while patrolling the same area where it all happened, I stopped in the clearing where I had seen the UFO. It looked just like any other part of the forest, peaceful and unremarkable. Standing there, I realized that I would never get the answers I was looking for. Whatever had visited that night was gone, leaving no trace behind but the impact it had on my life. I had to accept that some things are beyond our understanding, beyond our control. It wasn't an easy pill to swallow, but it was necessary. I learned to live with the memories, with the nightmares. They became a part of me, a testament to my strength, my survival. In the end, I found a sort of peace. Not because the questions had been answered, but because I had learned to live with the unknown. The experience had changed me, shaped me into someone new. I was no longer just a game warden. I was a survivor of something extraordinary, something otherworldly. And maybe that was enough. Maybe in the vast, unexplained universe, my story was just a small piece of a much larger puzzle, a puzzle I was okay with not completing. It was the kind of early morning where the darkness felt like a tangible thing, thick and all-consuming, the kind of morning that held its breath before the dawn. My alarm hadn't even chirped its first note before I was already rolling out of bed. The kind of instinct you develop when wildfires decide your schedule. My boots hit the floor with a purpose, the rest of my gear laid out like a silent testament to the day's potential dangers. There's a ritual to gearing up, a series of motions perfected over years that feels almost sacred in its repetition. Flame-resistant clothing, heavy boots, the reassuring weight of my personal fire shelter. It's a smoke jumper's armor against the unpredictable fury of nature. The air outside was crisp, the kind of chill that bites at the edges of your awareness, a sharp contrast to the heat we were about to face. The base was a hive of activity, lights cutting through the pre-dawn darkness, engines rumbling to life. You could feel the tension, a collective anticipation mixed with caffeine and adrenaline. We were a band of brothers and sisters, bound by a common purpose, and today, Northern California was calling. The briefing was succinct. The situation laid out with the kind of clarity that leaves no room for doubt. Lightning, nature's indiscriminate arsonist, had sparked a blaze in one of the most inaccessible stretches of forest we had the pleasure to know. With the winds acting as an accomplice, the fire was spreading, uncontained and hungry. Our mission was as straightforward as it was daunting. Jump in, establish a beachhead against the advancing flames, and give the ground crews a fighting chance. Flying over the target, the reality of what lay ahead began to sink in. Below us, a canvas of darkness was broken only by the ominous glow of the fire, a beacon of destruction in the tranquil wilderness. Throwing streamers to gauge the wind, we watched as they danced their way to the ground, a final check before the leap. The jump itself was a rush of adrenaline, a controlled fall into chaos. I've done this more times than I can count, but the thrill never dulls. The world shrinks to a point where it's just you, your parachute, and the earth rushing up to meet you. At 6:10, I made my exit. The familiar jolt of the chute deploying, the rapid adjustments to align with the landing zone. It was a textbook descent, ending with the grace of a practiced land, gear packed away with the efficiency of routine. I spotted my partner's chute as he made his landing, a sign that it was time to regroup and face the task ahead. The fire had a head start, its appetite fueled by the winds, tearing through the canyon with a voracity that left us with no illusions about the day's challenge. As we began our work, cutting fire breaks in a bid to corral the blaze, the sun crested the horizon, casting long shadows and painting the smoke in hues of gold and crimson. It was a moment of surreal beauty, a stark reminder of the thin line between destruction and awe that we walked as smoke jumpers. Little did we know, the day had a revelation in store for us that would transcend the fires we fought, a discovery that would blur the lines between myth and reality, challenging everything we thought we knew about the wilds we pledged to protect. The fire was a living thing, a beast that roared in the wind, feasting on the dry timber like it was nothing more than kindling. We worked with a fury, axes and shovels against an enemy that cared nothing for fatigue or fear. Sweat mixed with ash, painting us in the monochrome of the battle we waged. The work was grueling, a test of endurance and resolve, but we were smoke jumpers, born of fire and smoke, and we met the challenge head on. It was mid-morning when my partner Dan signaled me over. There was an urgency in his gesture that cut through the noise of the crackling flames and the distant roar of aircraft. I made my way to him, stepping over charred earth, the stench of burnt wood heavy in the air. "Over here," he shouted, his voice barely rising above the din of the fire. What I saw stopped me in my tracks. Amid the destruction, there was a tree, its trunk charred, flames dancing around its base. And there, high up in the branches, was something that didn't belong. My first thought was a bear, caught in a desperate bid for safety, but even from a distance, something about the shape was wrong. Dan handed me the binoculars, and I raised them to my eyes, the world zooming into sharp focus. It wasn't a bear. The figure was too large, too human. It hung limply, a victim of the smoke and the heat, and yet there was an undeniable otherness to it, a mystery wrapped in fur and shadow. "We need to report this," I said, but Dan was already on the radio, his voice steady but filled with a note of disbelief. As we waited for instructions, a sense of unease settled over me, a feeling that we'd stumbled upon something that defied explanation. The order came down quickly: evacuate the area. But before we could move, the brush to our front exploded with noise, a thunderous crashing that set every nerve on edge. And then it was there, emerging from the smoke like a specter. Another creature, similar to the one in the tree but very much alive. It stood there, towering and imposing, its fur a mottled gray against the blackened earth. Its eyes locked onto mine, and in that gaze, there was something unfathomable, a depth of emotion that spoke of fear, anger, and loss. It let out a sound, a scream that was both haunting and heart-wrenching, a cry that echoed in the hollows of my soul. The world seemed to pause, suspended in the moment, and then salvation came from above. A plane, one of ours, swooped low, releasing its load of fire retardant, a red cloud that enveloped the area. The creature turned, its gaze breaking from mine, and as the chemicals rained down, it took off, a shadow fleeing the encroaching light. Dan and I stood there, silent witnesses to something that defied belief. The fire raged on, indifferent to the mysteries it had unveiled, but for us, the world had shifted. We had seen the unseeable, and in the face of the fire's destruction, we'd glimpsed a sliver of the unknown that lay hidden in the wilds of Northern California. The rest of the day passed in a blur, the fire contained, but the encounter seared into our minds, a secret shared between the flames and the forest and us. The return to base was a silent affair, the drone of the engine a backdrop to the tumult of thoughts racing through my mind. Dan and I exchanged no words. What was there to say that could encompass what we'd seen? The fire, though contained, had ignited something else, a spark of the unknown that burned just as fiercely. The debrief was a sterile process, facts and figures laid bare, but when it came to the encounter, the narrative shifted. We recounted what we saw, each detail met with nods and scribbles on notepads, but the conclusion was foregone, delivered with a bureaucratic finality that brooked no argument. "You saw a bear," the official said, locking eyes with me, daring me to contradict. But I remained silent. The truth of what I saw held tight like a poker hand in a high-stakes game. The drive home was a chance to decompress, the familiar roads a balm to the day's chaos. Yet, the solitude offered no escape from the questions that circled like vultures. Had we really seen what I thought we saw? Was it possible, in this age of satellites and smartphones, for mysteries to still roam the vast, untouched corners of the world? I turned the events over in my mind, the image of the creature seared into my memory. It was no bear. Of that, I was certain. The features were too distinct, too human, and the emotion in its eyes too raw for any animal I'd known. And yet, admitting to this truth felt like stepping into a void, challenging the very nature of the known world. The decision to share the story, anonymously, was not made lightly. There was too much at stake, my career, my credibility, even my sanity in the eyes of some. But the weight of the secret was a burden too heavy to bear alone. The world needed to know, not because it would change anything, but because in the telling, a door was open to the possibility of wonders and horrors beyond our understanding. I penned the story in the quiet hours of the night, the words a confession of sorts, an acknowledgement of the vastness of our ignorance. It was a tale of fire and fury, of life and loss, and of the thin veil that separates our world from the unknown. As I clicked submit, sending my account into the ether, I felt a sense of release, a relinquishing of the guardianship of the secret. The reactions were as expected: skepticism, ridicule, a few tentative expressions of belief, but the truth of it mattered less than the act of sharing. A beacon for those who had also touched the edges of the unknown and found themselves wanting. In the end, the experience was a reminder of the fragility of our existence, a life shared not just with each other, but with the mysteries that dwell in the shadows. The forest had revealed its secret, not as a threat, but as a testament to the wonders that lie in wait for those brave or foolish enough to seek them. As I settled back into the routine, the fire a memory, and the encounter a whisper in the wind, I couldn't shake the feeling that the world was larger, stranger, and more beautiful than I'd ever imagined. And somewhere, in the heart of the forest, the mystery remained, a silent sentinel watching over its domain, waiting for the next wildfire to reveal its presence to the unseeing eyes of the world. Growing up in Kirby, Mississippi, wasn't exactly the stuff of adventure novels. The days stretched out long and hot, a monotonous blend of school, chores, and the occasional trip to the nearby creek to cool off. But there was one day, one defining moment that altered the course of my life, a moment as clear in my memory as the Mississippi sky on a cloudless day. I was 13, fueled by a mix of youthful rebellion and an insatiable curiosity for the world beyond Kirby's confines. That day, I found myself sneaking into the Roxy Theater to catch a screening of Sudden Impact, a film that hardly anyone in town thought suitable for a kid my age. It wasn't the thrill of evasion that stuck with me, though. It was Clint Eastwood, as Dirty Harry, standing tall and fearless, a beacon of justice in a world gone awry. From that day on, I didn't just want to become a cop. I wanted to be a detective, a rough-riding hammer of justice just like Dirty Harry Callahan. But life, I'd come to learn, wasn't like the movies. You can't just jump straight to the climax without first enduring the rising action. So, I put in the work, dedicated myself to school, and eventually earned my badge as a uniformed officer, patrolling the very streets I grew up on. It was rewarding, in its own way, but it felt like I was biding my time, waiting for the real action to begin. That action seemed to kick into gear the day I submitted my application to the Mississippi Bureau of Investigation. The MBI wasn't your run-of-the-mill police force. We were state special investigators, granted the freedom to pursue justice as we saw fit, all while wielding the same investigative powers as any other law enforcement agency. To me, joining the MBI was like being given the keys to the kingdom. Finally, I could make a real difference. My time in major crimes solidified my reputation within the Bureau. I was making a name for myself, but I hungered for more. That's when my supervisory agent approached me with an offer that would redefine my career. A new unit was being formed, unlike anything the Bureau had undertaken before. Its sole focus, cold cases. Other states had dedicated teams for such tasks, but Mississippi was behind the curve. Until now. The Public Safety Commissioner himself had requested the formation of this unit, and my name had come up as a potential member. The honor wasn't lost on me, but doubt crept in. Cold cases? That seemed a pursuit for those nearing the end of their careers, not someone still climbing the ladder. I voiced my concerns, but my supervisory agent saw things differently. My hunger, my drive, they were exactly what the unit needed. Cold cases might not offer the adrenaline rush of a hot pursuit, but they held the promise of something potentially more gratifying. Justice for those who had long been forgotten. With a mix of trepidation and excitement, I accepted the invitation. A few weeks later, as I sat in the first official meeting of the MBI's cold case unit, I couldn't help but feel the weight of expectation. These weren't just files. They were stories waiting for an ending, cries for justice that had gone unanswered for far too long, and I was determined to be the one to answer them. As the meeting adjourned, I picked up the first case file, its edges worn, its contents a mystery yet to be unraveled. I couldn't have known then how deeply it would consume me, how it would test my resolve and shake my understanding of justice. But in that moment, all I felt was a burning determination. This was it. This was my chance to make a difference, to chase down the shadows of the past and bring them into the light. Kirby, Mississippi might be where my story began, but it was within the pages of these cold cases that my true journey would unfold. The cold cases were a mountain of lost hopes and silent prayers, each file a testament to a moment where time stood still for someone, somewhere. I dug into them with the resolve of a miner searching for that one precious gem. That's when I found her, a Jane Doe. Her story buried under years of dust and bureaucratic indifference in a file marked Marshall County, 1993. The details were grim. Her body had been discovered dismembered, discarded like refuse on the side of a highway. Her existence reduced to police reports and the fading memory of the officer who found her. They said she'd been a prostitute, a drug user, maybe someone who'd simply fallen through the cracks. But to me, she was a mystery calling out across the years, begging to be solved. I started where the original investigation ended. The boot prints, size 12, red wings, had been the best lead, pointing to a known serial killer, George Jones. It was a solid theory. The man was already serving life for crimes eerily similar. But something didn't sit right with me. The dismemberment. The methodical removal of her head, hands, and feet. It was cold, calculated, not the frenzied signature of Jones. Poring over the old files, I noted two glaring inconsistencies. The first was the route Jones claimed to have driven the night she was believed to have been dumped. His truck's tachometer readings matched his story, placing him miles away from Marshall County, And then there was the manner of disposal. Jones's other victims bore the chaotic marks of his rage. Our Jane Doe, however, had been treated differently in death, her dismemberment bearing a clinical detachment that didn't match Jones's profile. Fueled by these doubts, I pushed deeper, retracing steps taken years before by detectives now long retired. My quest led me to the heart of the mystery, the identity of Jane Doe. Without a name, she was just another statistic, but I was convinced that unlocking her identity was the key to solving her murder. The search was exhaustive. I combed through missing persons reports, comparing dates, descriptions, any detail that might lead to a breakthrough. It was a painstaking process, but then, a glimmer of hope. A missing stepdaughter from 1991, a physical match, with a mother still aching for answers. The scar above her right elbow seemed like a sign from fate itself. I held my breath as the DNA results processed, daring to believe we were on the brink of giving Jane Doe back her name. But the results shattered that hope. No match. The disappointment was a physical weight, a blow to my gut that left me questioning my instincts. Yet, I couldn't let it go. The case refused to be silenced, its whispers turning into a roar that echoed through my thoughts day and night. The missing stepdaughter, the lies, the carefully constructed facade of a life. I sensed the truth was hidden just beneath the surface, obscured by years and a web of deceit. It was then I understood the true nature of my task. This wasn't just about solving a cold case. It was about unraveling a mystery that spanned decades, a story of loss, betrayal, and the elusive hope for justice. And as daunting as the path seemed, I was determined to follow it to the end, wherever it might lead. Jane Doe deserved that much. They all did. The cold, impersonal glow of my computer screen was the only light in the office as I sat there, the weight of countless unsolved stories pressing down on me. The Jane Doe case was a constant thorn in my side, a puzzle that refused to fit neatly into the picture I was trying to piece together. Her story, buried under the detritus of years and the all-too-easy assumptions of those who'd come before me, demanded more. It demanded truth. As I dug deeper, the fabric of the narrative began to unravel thread by thread. The father of the missing stepdaughter, a man shrouded in as much mystery as the case itself, became my focus. His story, I found, was built on a foundation of lies so elaborate they nearly obscured the chilling truth beneath. His life was a carefully constructed facade, his identity as fictitious as the alibis of the criminals I'd chased down in my earlier days on the force. The more I uncovered, the more I realized this wasn't just about a missing girl or an unidentified victim. It was about deception, about lives twisted by secrets so dark they were almost palpable. The breakthrough came when I matched the supposed father's social security number to a different name entirely, one with a sordid history that sent a chill down my spine. Indecent exposure. Attempted kidnapping. My gut clenched as I traced his movements, watching as he vanished only to reappear across the country. A new identity, a new life, and a young girl he claimed as his own. I wrestled with the implications, the growing horror at what might have transpired under the guise of a normal family life. The pieces were falling into place, each one a revelation that painted a grim picture of the fate that had befallen Jane Doe. The realization hit me like a freight train. The man who had lived a lie, who had hidden in plain sight, was not just a kidnapper. He was a murderer. The timing of his sudden departure, the day before Jane Doe's body was found, was more than coincidence. It was a confession written in the shadows of his actions. But as the truth came into focus, so did the magnitude of the challenge ahead. How do you convict a ghost? A man whose very existence was a question mark, who had slipped through the cracks of society to commit unspeakable acts. I felt a responsibility, not just to Jane Doe, but to every silent victim whose cries for justice had gone unanswered. Yet, as I sat in the dim light of my office, surrounded by the ghosts of the past, I knew that some truths came at a cost. Revealing the man behind the curtain would unravel not just his life, but the lives of those who had unknowingly been part of his deception. The weight of what lay ahead was daunting. It was a path lined with bureaucratic red tape and legal battles, a journey into the heart of darkness that promised no easy resolution. But as I looked back at the file on my desk, at the faceless woman who had become my charge, I knew there was no turning back. Justice, I had come to understand, was not just about solving cases. It was about unraveling the lies that bound us, about shining a light into the darkest corners of the human soul. And so, with a deep breath, I stepped into the fray, determined to chase down the shadows, no matter where they led. The sun was setting over the horizon, casting long shadows across the Mississippi landscape as I leaned against the hood of my car, parked outside the old, dusty office that had become my second home. The quiet of the evening was a stark contrast to the turmoil that churned within me, a reflection of the countless hours I'd spent wrestling with the cold case files that seemed to multiply with each passing day. The Jane Doe case had become a part of me, a constant companion in my thoughts. I had followed the trail as far as it would go, unraveling the complex web of lies that surrounded her untimely death. Yet, for all the progress I had made, I found myself at a standstill, facing the insurmountable barriers of bureaucracy and the limitations of the law. It was a bitter pill to swallow, the realization that justice was not always within reach, that some stories might never find their rightful ending. The frustration was palpable, a weight that pressed down on my shoulders, a reminder of the imperfect world we live in. But amidst the disappointment, there was also a sense of resolve. I had delved into the depths of humanity's darkest moments, and I had emerged with a deeper understanding of the resilience of the human spirit. The cases I had worked on, the lives I had touched, they had left an indelible mark on me, shaping the person I had become. I thought of the families I had met along the way, the faces of those who had lost loved ones to the cruel hand of fate. Their stories were a testament to the enduring hope that drives us forward, the belief that, even in the face of overwhelming odds, there is always a chance for redemption. As the last light of day faded into the twilight, I knew that my time with the cold case unit was drawing to a close. The years had taken their toll, and I felt the pull of a quieter life, one far removed from the chaos and heartache that had become my daily bread. But as I prepared to step away, to pass the torch to those who would follow in my footsteps, I couldn't help but feel a sense of pride. We had fought the good fight, pushed back against the darkness, and in our own way, made a difference. Jane Doe, and all the others like her, would forever be a part of me, a reminder of the journey I had undertaken. Their stories, though unfinished, would continue to inspire, to serve as a beacon of hope in a world that so often seemed devoid of it. In the end, I realized that justice was not just about the cases we solved or the criminals we brought to book. It was about the lives we touched, the difference we made, even in the smallest of ways. And as I looked out over the landscape that had been the backdrop to my career, I knew that, in some small corner of the world, we had left it a little better than we had found it. The road ahead was uncertain, but I faced it with a sense of peace, knowing that, even in the shadows, there was always a glimmer of light, a flicker of hope. And for now, that was enough.